On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Today on The Conversation Hour, we bring you a very special chat with Joan Baez. We Shall Overcome by Joan Baez, who was our guest on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria with a very excited live audience. Yes, that's right, ladies and gentlemen, a live audience for The Conversation Hour today on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, and good morning to you all. Good morning, 3F2. I just instantly felt like I was in class. Derek Gill is my co-host and Joan Baez will be our special guest with some competition winners in the back studio here at the ABC South Bank Centre. Derek, good morning to you.
Good morning, John. It's nice to be back in this room too. Such fond memories of so many of our live-to-airs broadcast from in this studio.
I don't know if you ever get to the point since your semi-retirement from the radio, since you walked out and dudded the rest of us and left us weeping in your wake.
Thank you.
Have there been times when you've missed it, when big things happen?
Yeah, there have been times. Usually, though, more often than not, it's been those occasions when I've seen a band and I've thought to myself, now, if I had a radio program, I could get that band on and I could give them an opportunity to talk to a huge audience all at once. So it's more often about that. The further removed I become from my years at the microphone, the less I'm inclined to want to discuss political things apart from around the dining table.
Yes, and that's bad enough as it is.
It is, ladies, as you've met my friends then.
Yes. Ladies and gentlemen, Derek Gill, my co-host. Wonderful to have him back in the studio. In a moment, we will be joined by Joan Baez. Going back as far as you like in folk music, back to the early days of folk music festivals, and even, as we say, she's here direct from Woodstock, although there have been a few things in between. A remarkable life, both performing and also as an activist and someone who has never let a good cause go past. Ladies and gentlemen, Joan Baez is our guest here at South Bank as she tours around. Joan Baez, welcome to Melbourne and wonderful to have you here.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
And it was wonderful to hear you performing back just the other day in 1959.
It was just a little blink of the eye. Yeah.
Do you pinch yourself from time to time?
Actually, I do, kind of. I mean, when I hear something, I haven't listened to anything that goes back that far in a while. I marvel at the voice. Voice changes over the years, so that little high soprano really isn't there at all. And I think, oh, pooey, I wish I could still do that, but I can still listen to it.
And there's still so much that you can and do. In fact, the reviews for your performances here in Australia have been raving about how you've maintained so much of your range.
Yeah, it's not about range. It's about probably now 55. I mean, that was 55 years ago. So there's been that much living in between then and now, and there's been that much singing, there's been that much conflict, activism, a full life, and that comes out in the voice, comes out in the strength and the lower range, and just all of what I just said is just packed in there and it still comes out.
Where did it all start, Joan? How did the singing bug bite you?
I think the singing bug came when I was 13, because one, I was bored in school. We moved too much. I didn't really have any close friends. And so I was lonely. Somebody gave me a ukulele, and I just amused myself. I mean, I learned the three chords that you need for all the rhythm and blues songs that were on the radio, and I just sang them to myself, you know, in the evening and after school. And then I decided I'd take the ukulele to school, and I discovered that people would listen, you know. The voice was still, had no vibrato, it was just a child's voice, you know. And literally, I wanted that vibrato. I didn't know I was going to get it to that extent. But I stood in front of the bathroom mirror and I wiggled my Adam's apple up and down to get that sound. And I did that constantly, and eventually it came.
But where does your performer spirit come from?
I mean, fire in the belly?
Yeah.
I'm not sure. I've always felt that the voice was the first gift, And the second gift was the desire to use it the way I've used it.
And a determination too.
Yeah. Yeah, stubborn determination, yeah. But it's having a goal. I mean, it's deciding at a very early age that I was really here on earth not to just perform, not to just be, but to really be involved with the human race and being and with other people. And I saw, maybe, I know, I was in 10, I was 10 years old, we lived in Baghdad for a year.
Now, your father was an academic.
He was, yeah.
And so you went to what would have then been called Persia, I suppose.
No, it was Iraq.
Iraq, yeah, rather.
Mesopotamia.
Sorry, not Tehran,
been, yeah.
To Mesopotamia. So that early exposure then.
Yeah, to real human misery. I mean, I hadn't seen anything like that. And the level of poverty and the level of sickness and it doesn't, I mean, it can't be that. It can be whatever it resonated in me. And those reasons, I don't really know. But it did. And I think it was about that time, and I was 10 or 11, that I really felt a connection with people who were suffering.
So that made you different to other kids?
Yeah, it did. And especially being away overseas, and they... You know, I would write back to my school friends or the people I knew there and try to tell them about Baghdad. They didn't care about Baghdad, you know.
So you've got a childhood passion for social justice, mm-hmm. Which you didn't probably realise was what it was when you were 10, but there's that concept. There's the concept of working on your voice and knowing that you wanted to do something with it. But then it's the amalgam of entertainment mm-hmm. and activism. Which I would posit is not necessarily an easy thing to do.
It's probably not easy, but the sacrifice, the real difficulty, the putting myself out or whatever, it's just the opposite. If I had to not do the things that I've done, that would be difficult. That would have been, you know, that would have been an unfulfilled life.
No, it's who you were, but you know, we have a look at, there's some great examples of people who, for whatever reason, have either turned their back on their concepts of social justice or turned their back on a great career because they couldn't find the way to meld the two.
I've always been the happiest and most productive when I have both of those hats on at the same time. It came easily, and it is where the fire in the belly starts and really catches. So, and that remains consistent still now.
A lot of people in your position, though, get waylaid or distracted by the trappings of fame.
Yeah.
Money, glamour, red carpet.
Yeah,
they believe their own BS.
You should see us after a show or before. Glamour. You know, there's no such thing, really. I mean, yeah, you put on a lot of makeup and try to get my hair right and wear the right clothes and stay slim and all this stuff. But I sometimes laugh at the situation I'm in. You know, I'm picking ticks off my dog or something. I think, yeah, this is really the star's life, you know. And that's so important to keep that, you know, that perspective.
Don't you have staff to take the tick off
your
dog?
You haven't got a dog ticker.
I haven't got a dog ticker, but thanks for the idea.
So how do you keep your feet on the ground? I mean, people, and look, I'm not telling any stories out of school, but we get a lot of people coming through the studio mm-hmm. who have a thousandth of your celebrity and a thousandth of your talent and achievements, but surround themselves with airs and graces and minders and making all sorts of fancy demands and preconditions. And
you just explained it. If they're a thousandth of, or if they're still really groping for, or haven't quite got there, or, you know, a lesser performer, or whatever, however they conceive of themselves, then it could, you know, you might need to be bolstered constantly. But also at the beginning, I thought I was just righteous. Actually, I was probably petrified. I didn't want that. I didn't want the world, commercial world. I mean, I remember I was 19, and this guy was Dylan's manager, Janis Joplin's manager, he was the guy, it was Albert Grossman, and he wanted to manage me, and he took me to New York City and took me to Columbia Records, which is where John Hammond worked, and Hammond worked with all these people. It was assumed that that's where I would go, and I walked in that place, and there were gold albums all up and down the hallway, and I started catching a cold. I mean, by the time I left there, I was sick, and he's standing over me trying to get me to sign this contract saying yes for 4 years, I think, Columbia. And that's tremendous pressure. And I think at that moment, I think, no, I can't do this. And then I took Vanguard, which is basically a classical music company, because I, you know, respected their taste. And I'm, you know, I'm glad. I have no regrets.
Is it true you used to vomit before a performance?
No, it's just the opposite. I would not vomit. If I had enough sense to vomit, I would have felt better afterwards. But I couldn't. I was one of those non-vomit people, so I just felt sick and had the occasional case of diarrhea, but that's as close as I could come to throwing up. But, yeah, I had terrible stage fright for a long time. And there's nothing, you know. Over the years, it got better a little bit at a time. And then diving into the serious therapy was starting when I was 50. And eventually unearthed a lot of this stuff. And when I had done that work, I don't have stage fright anymore.
So what led you to decide at 50 that it was time to seek to get some help?
Yeah, well, I had gotten help since I was in my teens. But that help helped me avoid, what was really niggling away in there. And I don't know how I would have lived without that help. Because it helped me get over and around and under whatever the serious stuff was, but never through. And then I think it became clear. It took a half a century, I can't dodge this bullet anymore. So we went and tackled it.
One of my favorite of your songs is Gabriel and Me.
Yeah.
And just for those who don't know, it's a beautiful portrait of a mother's love for her son. But that was also one of the difficulties of your life, too, being so busy and having a family and trying to make those things work.
Yeah, too. Exactly. I would just say on that subject, I'm lucky. I have my son traveling with me now. A lot of moms get to hang out with their daughters after they're grown up, but not many moms get to hang out with their sons. Yeah. And so, and he's chastised me for worrying about the past. He said, oh, Mom, give it up. We're fine. I'm happy. You were there at a time nobody else could have done what you did, and that's that. And he travels as my percussion player, and so I just had breakfast with him. He's 46. I said, whoopee, I get to have this time with my lovely boy.
And how are you enjoying grandmotherhood?
I don't know if I'm a good grandmother. I'm getting to be a good grandmother now.
Be careful. Derek will pull out pictures of his grandchildren at the drop of a hat and start showing them to you.
Yeah, but this is just TV. Compare. This is not TV, so there's no point.
No point. That's right.
He doesn't need a camera. He'll just do it whether you want him to or not.
Well, I just scored. Jasmine owes me for the rest of my life. I got her to a Taylor Swift concert.
Did you go?
Yeah. Taylor is an absolutely lovely woman. And I was prepared to think that she was going to be awful. I thought, well, we're on VIP. That would mean we go into a room and she says hi and stamps her arms with her, with a stamp of her signature. She's an absolutely lovely woman. And she had just Julia Roberts and her family, me and my family, her Taylor's family, and the guy who makes her pianos, and that's who was there. And it was hugging and chatting and, real conversation. I was completely baffled. And my granddaughter was just, really, I think grandmother had a whole new glow to it after that.
Well, it goes to show those showbiz connections, they have all sorts of payoffs, even some that you didn't anticipate. Do you keep in touch with all the people? Your career, you've worked with everyone.
I haven't stayed as much in touch as I should have, could have. And I've sort of just started doing that. What the hell, why not start it in the twilight of my life, keeping people's names when I come and go.
And are there people who, even if it's not a creative collaboration, just a friendship, people who, if Joan Baez has to draw up a mental list of the people who you say, I really wish I'd stayed in touch with?
Oh, probably about 50 people that I really wish I'd stayed in touch with.
Starting with?
I think that all of us at a certain age are going to end up with about 5 or 6 people who really mean something to us. Mm-hmm. And whether or not that's a fellow entertainer is sort of beside the point. So it's more choose the people that are going to last with you.
So there's family, but then there's the people who you choose to stay close to, as opposed to those who you in some way are destined
right.
to stay
exactly.
close to. And that I mean, some families are all different, so yeah. it's up to you how far you want to go down that path. But of the people you choose, are they people who are showbiz names, or are they behind the scenes people? Is it a roadie or an accountant or is it a performer? How does it work?
No, it's just, you know, I don't know where friends come from. One of them is my son's godmother. You know, I've known her for almost 50 years. And, you know, when you see somebody you end up absolutely comfortable with, there are five or six people you wouldn't know in my life who fill that role.
And the celebrity side of things, are there celebrities? I mean, you know, you and Bob Dylan, you were his girlfriend, he was your boyfriend, and, you know, everyone speculates, and there are probably theses and PhDs that have been written about it and all. But then there's
Bob saying one time, well, after I'm dead, people are going to... they're going to analyze these songs. He said, they won't know what the F I'm talking about. He said, I don't know what the F I'm writing about. So and on the subject, while we're on it, it was an Australian interviewer said, are you still in touch with Bob Dylan? And I said, nobody is in touch with Bob Dylan. So.
And he's gone down a completely different path.
Yeah.
Was here recently touring yet again, and just seems to...
I don't think he stopped.
Yeah, and like Leonard Cohen, someone else you've worked with.
Yeah.
I mean, just Leonard, in their own...
Yeah.
In their
own
space.
Their own universe.
Yep.
I mean, Leonard's got a massive universe. He just kind of re-entered it after he came out of the monastery, which he said he hated. I love that. You know, he's so devoted to the Zen Buddhism, and he came out, he couldn't stand a minute of it. I love that. So much of your spiritual life, you know.
He was there for 5 years or something, wasn't he?
He was a long time.
Oh. Slow learner.
No, it's interesting. The other side of that is, are there people that you... because I remember listening to the Ring Them Bells all those years ago, not that long ago, but and the different people you were working with there, are there still people that you think, I would really like to work with?
I still do. We're going to do a great performances show in the States. It's a public television show, and usually it's an opera or a ballet or three tenors or things like that. So I'll do one, and I have now, I think, 10 guests. And no, they're people I do love. It's not, you know, they don't come to my house every weekend, but the Indigo Girls are really lovely friends. Yeah. Chapin Carpenter is, Jackson Brown, Robert Plant, just reconnected with this last summer, Patti Smith. And I mean, I like all these people. These people are people I consider to be my friends.
Mary Chapin was a guest just a few weeks ago when she was in town, and she pretty much said she's in love with you still too. So there you go. On 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria, it's just past 11:30.
On ABC Radio Melbourne and Victoria, this is The Conversation Hour with John Fain.
Broadcasting from the performance studio here at the ABC Studios in South Bank with Joan Byers, our guest. We have an audience of people who won a little competition we ran to be here to provide us with the energy that comes from a live performance with Derek Giel, my co-host on this Conversation Hour, this special Conversation Hour with Joan Byers today. Joan, over your now 60 years of performing and activism, you've acquired extraordinary connection to Martin Luther King, Barack Obama, and all the rest of it. So I can't think of a better person to explain Donald Trump to an Australian audience.
Nobody's ever been in touch with Donald Trump.
Can you explain for Australians? We don't understand. We just can't work out what's going on with Donald Trump.
Well, I'm happy to say that I'm in that category as well. There are some different hints about it. One is a thing I heard, which I believe is true, that the bigger the lie, the more people are going to believe it, if they're unbright enough. We have a lot of our population is not. I mean, the whole Tea Party phenomenon, I think, came out of the people who were disenfranchised during the Civil Rights Movement. I mean, I think that during that time, we were a whoop-de-doo, hooray, because they really were victories. And during that time, nobody thought about the folks who were really angry and, you know, for many, many years. And so I think when a Tea Party advocate stands up and says, oh, I've had enough, I don't think they even know what they're talking about. But I think it is connected with the fact that they cannot stand having a black person as president. I mean, there are a lot of different reasons. I know that the right wing has 50 think tanks, and what they do in there is they think and they plan. How are we going to really take over? And liberals and progressives have not learned how to keep up with that. So a phrase will come out, very clever. I mean, it's planned. What two words are going to make this work? For instance, originally it was global warming. And then the two words came out, climate change, because it sounds a little bit nicer. And then everybody uses, we all get around to using. I mean, the right wing has access to the press. They practically own the press. So they can back, you know, immediately the phrase will come out. I mean, the most exaggerated form was the cradle of civilization became the axis of evil. And so in the middle of that hodgepodge, only he has shocked everybody, Trump has.
Including the conservatives. I mean, the mainstream Republicans are terrified about what it might mean, but the juggernaut rolls on.
Yeah, it does. And no, he has surprised everybody with his, you know, blatant disgustingness, because it is really disgusting. And I think...
But where does it go to? Because it now looks in the fragmented field of candidates for the Republican nomination are saying, well, hang on, this has got way past where anyone thought it would go. We've got to now sit down and work out a strategy. Or before we know it, he will be
president,
the Republican nominee.
If we don't, I mean, at least the nominee. I think people love to say, oh, it's just ridiculous. They'll get past this phase. I don't think that's true. I think that's something about the lies. I mean, to that mentality, truth doesn't make any difference. Facts don't make any difference at all. If you want to convince somebody of your point of view, or that it's, you know, that your activism, your strong beliefs, pick somebody who is undecided. Because if you pick somebody who's already decided, it's a waste of breath. It's not. I mean, we're the same, really. You know, if somebody tried to convince me to, you know, be a member of apartheid, it wouldn't happen. I mean, it could.
But being rational and logical isn't working when the person you're dealing with has no regard for being rational and logical. He contradicts himself every second time he opens his mouth and then just keeps on going.
Yeah. Something to do with the Teflon phenomenon, which started with Reagan, that conservatives are able to do whatever they want, say whatever they want, for whatever reason. It's Teflon. I mean, you throw something at them and there are some lovely conservatives and some really bright ones. So we're talking about the fringy, but it's a large fringe.
And it strikes me that it's a symptom of the simple solutions for complex problems. And that Peter Finch character in Network, I'm as mad as hell and I'm not going to take it anymore, which all very well to express what you're mad about, that you are mad, but work out what it is that you're mad about, then work out what's the process to stop being mad or to change the cause. Oh, you got, you know, but there's, anyway, that's a, may you live in interesting times.
That's a nice roundup.
Yeah.
Has there ever been a cause that Joan Baez has said no to?
Oh, many, many, many. Because I always based whatever work I was doing, whatever the causes were, were based on the foundation of nonviolence, which immediately eliminates many, 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 many groups. And they may be good groups with good intentions, but if it's not got that basis to it, then I've never been comfortable working in a context like that. There's a good example. We were just going to, in the United States, go out on a tour and try to highlight the mass arrests of black people and the lethal force issue, death penalty. And one of the suggestions was you reopen the discussion about what is lethal force. And what is, in each state it's different, and what should be allowed, and should this be allowed, and it should be not excessive force, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Bottom line is, if you do all these things right and change the police force and everybody follows rules, you can still kill a guy. You know, and I realized it was not exactly where I wanted to be. I mean, I have to find a cause, you know, that makes sense to me and hopefully will make sense to other people.
So you must almost be like a clearinghouse. Do you get you must be bombarded with people saying, can you help us with this concert or performance or
I have a wonderful assistant, and her job is learning every possible way to nicely say no. Yes. She's got it down.
Yes, that's good, yes.
One of the hardest things of all. But then there would be many compelling and even emotionally powerful causes that fit totally within your template, but you're not able to do them.
Yeah, well,
you're picking and choosing all the time.
I think that probably that's one of the things that people are... I mean, one of the things people today are lacking, missing, is the feeling and the sense that we had in those days, in the 60s and early 70s, that we had each other. And we could really do anything. But the main things we were doing was civil rights and trying to end the war in Vietnam. So it was very clear. And now there are too many things for people. I mean, it's just impossible. And it's a raging state of violence that we're living in right now.
There's a growing body of thought that says that the world's getting worse, not better, that there's a crisis in democracy. And Donald Trump or Silvio Berlusconi are used as examples. We've got our own instability now in our democratic institutions in this country, which has surprised many of us that we're as fragile and vulnerable as we've turned out to be. And a lot of people are saying, well, you know, all through the post-World War II period, we've been pretty smug and self-satisfied about where we thought we were heading, but we're actually not getting there. What does Joan Baez think?
Oh, I think that, I think these are terribly difficult times. I've never been an optimist. When I was 15, somebody said I was naive. And I said, I didn't think I was naive. I thought I was a realist. And realistically speaking, I really don't know how we're going to pull through this time period. If people can somehow wake up to themselves and to the firestorm that we're living in, somehow or other, we might be able to find direction. My little dream that comes up is that understanding what happened when Obama was running for office and giving those extraordinary speeches, the world shifted. I mean, that's the only time young people have experienced the feeling that we had back in the 60s and 70s. So at least they know it exists, a feeling that we can do that, we can make change. And if he would get out of office and go back to organizing on the streets, there would be a possibility for a real movement of change, I think.
It's not about to happen, but you look, for instance, there are now trillions of dollars that multinational corporations offshore to tax havens, so they aren't contributing to the maintenance, the upkeep of the societies that they trade in. There are disparities the likes of which we've never seen between the ordinary people and the mega-rich that even make the 1920s and the excesses pale to insignificance. You could probably go back maybe feudal times. It might have been like that between the peasants and the aristocracy. Yeah. I don't know. But we thought we were more sophisticated. We thought we'd found ways to solve these sorts of problems. You look at the tide of human misery coming out of Syria and the Middle East and washing through Europe and numbers that no one's got a clue how to accommodate.
I know.
On it goes from there.
Yeah, well, I hope you're not asking me a question about how to answer it, because
I want you to sing a song about it. We shall overcome. Because, I mean, that's the role that, you know, you've played that role. You've provided people over the lives of everyone in this room and people who are listening. You've been a cause for hope and a rallying call.
Ain't let nobody turn me around, turn me around, turn me around. Ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Keep on walking, keep on talking, keep on singing, keep on swinging. Gonna build a brand new world.
Minutes to 12, I don't know quite what we can do that takes us anywhere after that. Joan Baez bursting into song for us here in the performance studio at the back of the ABC studios in South Bank. John Fain with you, with Derek Gill, my co-host, on 774 ABC Melbourne, ABC Victoria, digital radio and the World Wide Web.
On a different subject then, can we talk about painting? How long have you been painting?
4 years.
4 years. Mm-hmm. There's you can go onto the web and you can type in Professor Google, Joan Baez painting images, and you'll see there's a Facebook page and so mm-hmm. forth. It seems that portraiture
I just started off. I've always sketched and, you know, did pastels, whatever, junior high school, high school, in the high school yearbooks, I was going to be an artist. But I never took it very seriously. And then one day, I thought, you know what? I want to start painting. I could feel it in my hands. And we found a woman near where I live who was, you know, nothing spectacular. She was a teacher. So I went and I said, I want an art lesson. She said, what do you want to do? I said, I want you to get my hands in the paint. So literally, she was wonderful. We got these big piles of paint, smushed it all over the page and started doing collages. And that's how it began. That was 4 years ago. And then as it's gone along, it kind of narrowed into portraits. And that's what I've loved doing. So. And today I was on my way to the art store after I leave here.
Yes.
I didn't bring paints with me because I thought Australia was going to be difficult. I thought it was going to take a lot of time to prepare for concerts. It doesn't at all. The audiences are just splendid. So I just go out there and whatever happens, happens. And so I have time to do a little painting.
Well, Derek's available if you need a subject for a portrait.
I wouldn't. I would. Good head for radio.
I'll volunteer him. His only trouble is he can't sit still for that long. So that would be a problem.
I won't use a live subject. I'm too codependent. I'm thinking, they need some tea. They must be so uncomfortable in that position. I could never do it. I just do it from photographs.
Okay, but if you're painting even from a photograph, I guess what the whole process of a portrait is to get to the essence of the person.
Yeah.
Which is completely in tune with your authenticity, getting to the essence, the emotion of a song.
Maybe, yeah.
Or am I trying to draw too long a bow?
No, I don't think so. No, I just hadn't thought about it. But, yeah, it is the essence. And if you don't get the essence, then it doesn't work. I mean, it doesn't work for me, so.
So are there challenges, musical challenges, that Joan Baez is still looking forward to, or?
But Joan Baez is in the middle of constant challenges. If you think of the vocal cord as a muscle, and me as an athlete, then you'll get an idea of how difficult it is at my age, to 74, to keep that muscle flexible. It means if I were a tennis player, I'd have to be out on the court every day, you know. And so I am. I do vocalizing every day. The vocal cord just starts getting tighter and stiffer and calcifies at the ends. So a few years ago, I was so disgusted with it because I want to hear that sound we heard at the beginning when I was 19.
From 1959.
And so I went to a ear, nose, and throat man and I said, you know, what's wrong here? He said, nothing. I said, you mean this is what I've got from here on out? He said, yeah, it's lovely. If you want to work with it, I'll get you to a vocal therapist and we'll open up some of those things. His theory was that I was clamping down on everything because I didn't want to hear the sounds that were coming out. I wanted to hear something from 30 years ago. So once I accepted that it was a 71-year-old voice and that I could get some flexibility back and get some fun back, then I stayed in the game. I was ready to just stop.
So the problem wasn't in the throat. The problem was between your ears.
You're absolutely right, yeah.
So once you overcame that concern, that anxiety, back again to anxiety, you could still do all. I mean, you just burst into a magnificent, I mean, unprepared, unwarmed up. You couldn't ask for more, could you, ladies and gentlemen? I mean, it's nothing to be in any way self-conscious about. But then we're all like that as we get older, I think, aren't we? We all think about how much better we pretended we used to be, for most of us, but you actually were.
When we were younger and stupider.
Yeah. And at the same time, though, to age gracefully. I know Derek wants to age disgracefully, but to age...
I want to do both.
Yes, yeah.
To age gracefully, but to still be creative in what many call a third age, is that an ambition?
Well, it's a necessity for me. I realize that when I don't have something in me, I think it was partly from I can come to Australia, I'm really going to have to work on these songs. And then when I didn't have to, it's immediately, what am I going to do with this time? you know, and the next thing was paint. I mean, I'm an output all the time. You know, I don't read very well because it's intake. I just go back to output.
But then when you are painting, it's the same sort of focus that you would have if you were writing a song.
Exactly,
just
yeah.
Determination and single-mindedness for that moment.
Yeah.
Are you your own harshest critic, like lots of high-achieving people?
I hope so. I don't want anybody else to criticize. People say, oh, but that's constructive criticism. Hell, I don't like any criticism. I don't care if it's constructive or not. I just want everybody to say, I want a marvelous portrait. I think I'll buy it.
Yeah, great record. I have that one. Thank you. Yes,
you do, because people assume that since I'm me, you know, Miss World Peace and everything, that I just want to paint for the beauty of painting and keep the stuff in my home. I said, hell no. I want to have a great big exhibition, and people are going to say, oh, those are wonderful. How much you charge? Said, that's not very Joan Baez, but it is realistic.
To be able to laugh at yourself is a pretty important ingredient. A lot of people take themselves so seriously that they can't do that.
There's so many things in the world we could take seriously, and then we end up taking ourselves seriously, which is, you know, ridiculous. I think the Buddhists are very helpful to me in that way. I'm not a Buddhist, but, you know, those monks who are probably the wisest people we have on earth are always giggling. Everything's a big joke. Mm. You know, they know how deep it is. They know how real it is. They know how to live and how to die, and they giggle. You know, they know that in some way you just can't be that serious or it'll be the end of you.
Has religion never played a role in your life?
You know, I don't like people saying I'm not religious, I'm just spiritual. But the fact is I don't have a church. I was not born a Quaker. My family became Quakers when I was 8. It's different becoming a Quaker. Nixon was born a Quaker, which didn't mean anything, you know. He would bring that out. But if you're born into a Quaker faith, it doesn't mean anything until you've made up your own mind about it. So I made up my mind about my own personal religion, you could call it, which involved all of pacifism. And you can't kill people. And the Quakers are probably the only established religion which really and truly takes that seriously. I mean, there are Quakers who become very unpopular because they won't fight in a popular war. I mean, World War II draft resistors were not on the happy list, mm-hmm. you know, for anybody. But that's where I am with it.
Now, I wonder, then the extent to which religion is at the core of so many of the problems that we're facing across the world today, too, is I would find it hard to align myself with any religion when you have a look at the things that religions have done in the name of God or whatever.
Well, I think that what happens is you can say, love thy neighbor, thou shalt not kill, and all this stuff. And in a domestic and personal context, it all makes sense. But as soon as you're called up to go fight a war, it's as though that's just in another book. Mm. It has nothing to do with your, you know, personal convictions. And the Quakers, for the most part, you know, absolutely stick to that conviction that human lives are more important than turf, than religion, than your nationalism. And you just have to stick to it.
Mm. During the Vietnam War, you, along with, for instance, Jane Fonda, were one of the celebrities who went to visit the enemy. Mm-hmm. Any regrets?
You know, the first thing that comes to my mind is somebody asking Gandhi what he would do if some stranger broke into his house. And he said, oh, there's no such thing as a stranger. Mm-hmm. Well, he was pretty radical on the subject. But, yeah, thoughts were that we did not know, those of us who went on this, it was a little party of 4 people going to visit the North Vietnamese, take letters to the POWs and just meet and greet with North Vietnamese. And we were there for 3 days and the bombing started. I hadn't gone there thinking that it was going to be a bombing, you know. But it was the heaviest bombing actually in the history of the world. And I ended up there and had to deal with my mortality, you know, just looking around me, seeing that I ain't going to last any more than anybody else is. And by the way, speaking of religion, when those bombs get close, everybody prays. Yes. Everybody. Atheists, oh, Jesus, God, please get me out of this. I don't want to die. I want to die. It's terrible, but it just, that's the way it is. And the planes get closer, and you get more and more, don't let it happen to me, don't let it happen to me. And they start going away, and you think, well, where's it going to happen? You know, who is going to get killed in my place? So, in other words, wars have not been the very efficient way to handle, you know, our lives.
They don't seem to impose peace very easily, do they?
No, they don't. No. And people are constantly making another war film saying, well, this one will show people how terrible war is. Yeah, it doesn't. It just is another, you know, feast of violence.
Yeah. 7 minutes to 12 on The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne, ABC Victoria, digital radio and the World Wide Web as well. We've got a few more minutes with Joan Baez, Derek Giel, my co-host. I've got a fabulous text here for you, Joan. Donald Trump supporters sing We Shall Overcome.
I'm glad Pete's dead. You know what? There's a song that came from the Sacco and Vanzetti film, which was popular all over Italy and France. And
now, Sacco and Vanzetti were the two accused of communist spying.
Right.
Executed.
Right.
Yep.
And there's a little song that I wrote. It's very, very, very popular. It's about five or six lines. And it's known in these many places as, you know, standing for exactly that, for Sacco and Vanzetti and causes and good things and socialism. And I sang it when I was in Brazil. And it was 81, it was under the dictator. And all of my concerts were canceled by the government. So we planned all these little ways to, you know, to get heard. And one was I went to a theater and the guy giving the concert would stop all of a sudden and then I would stand up and sing. So I sang a couple of things and then I sang this famous little wonderful political song and there was this dead silence. I said, what happened? They said, well, the army's using it for a recruiting song, you know? But how would I have known, you know? So, and you have somebody in Australia who just said a very nice, I can't remember his name, a writer, songwriter, somebody was using his material for, yeah.
Yes.
And he just said,
I don't want that. And the same's happened with Trump.
Yeah, but he said it a very nice way. Yeah. You know, he said, that's not what Australia stands for, that's not what I stand for.
Yeah, Shane Howard, yes. And there's been a whole lot of artists who have told Donald Trump to stop playing their songs as a as an entry piece and all the rest of it back to Mr. Trump, which we shouldn't
that's
be doing.
Right.
Of the people you've shared a stage with, Pete Seeger you just mentioned a moment ago, who do you miss the most of those that have already shuffled off?
Well, I don't know that I miss them on a daily basis. I would say the ones that hugely meaningful in my life would be Pete. You know, that he was the first person I knew who was welding together his activism and his beliefs with the music. And when I found out, which I did early, that Time Magazine was at his house, have an interview, and he was on the roof shingling. He said, I'll come down as soon as I'm through. And I thought, this is a guy I really would like to know.
And who kept performing into his 90s.
He did. He did. And he couldn't sing at all. And it didn't make any difference at all. No. You know, really. He sounded as if he was gargling. And the whole place would gargle with him. You know?
I was at a concert in New York that was for a prisoner called Leonard Peltier,
yes,
who is
yeah.
campaigning still for his release after being in jail for years and years and years. Long and complicated story. But Harry Belafonte was the MC. Jackson Brown was one of the performers
yeah.
and Pete Seeger. It's incredible.
Yeah.
Still going strong. It was only a few years ago.
Yeah. No, he was just splendid. And you couldn't stop him. I mean, he paid for his beliefs. I mean, that's the thing that's missing for the most part now is the willingness to take a risk. We had that back in the day, again, because we had that feeling it was okay. I remember being arrested for some demonstration in California. I think it was trying to replace bombs with bags of rice. That's what it was. It was one of those symbolic things. And some woman was saying, I can't make up my mind. This side of the street was supporters, and this side were people who were going to get arrested. She said, I can't make up my mind. And I said, well, is stuff, what's happening at home? Do you have somebody, do you have kids? She said, yeah, but I have somebody who could take care of them. I said, well, you know, jump in. And she was ready. If you're not ready, then you don't. She was ready. But that's the risk-taking that's hard for people to even imagine now. A lot of people, except for a few. You know.
Do you take a leaf out of Pete Seeger's songbook? Do you keep going when you're just gargling on stage, but you're still standing there?
No, I thought I was gargling. And then this guy, the ear, nose and throat guy, said, well, you're not gargling, you're just 71.
But is it your intention to keep going for as long as
no,
you're standing up?
No, absolutely not. I had the best voice teacher I ever had many years ago, and I said, well, how will I know when it's time to quit singing? He said, your voice will tell you. So.
Well, there doesn't seem any indication of it, none whatsoever.
So how many concerts a year would be the normal thing for you, Jo?
60-some.
About 60?
60-some.
Better than one a week. That's not bad. Yeah.
Not bad.
It's not bad.
In between painting Derek's portrait.
Yeah, well, that's right. Squeeze me in somewhere.
Boy, I've got a lot to do while I'm here.
You have. You'll be very busy, yes.
But it's what... It's obviously, you know, it's keeping you young, it's keeping you fresh, it's keeping you going, it's extraordinary.
Well, I'm lucky to want to do this.
No, we are lucky. We are the lucky ones, aren't we, yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, to Joan Baez. Ladies and gentlemen, could you say a big thank you to Joan Baez? On 774 ABC Melbourne, this has been The Conversation Hour.
I let nobody turn me around, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around. Keep on walking, keep on talking, keep on singing, keep on swinging, gonna build a brand new world.